Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, this is a special live edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Boston Globe political editor Shira Center.
Well, as wow. You can hear, they're pumped. We are broadcasting live before a pumped audience here at the Campus Center at UMass Boston. Today is our kickoff to campaign season and an official introduction to the two Democratic candidates for governor, Bob Massey and Jay Gonzalez. The Democratic gubernatorial debate today is hosted by WBUR, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston, and the Boston Globe.
The Democratic gubernatorial primary will be held on September 4th before the general election on November 6th. We'll get started in just a moment. We've asked both candidates to prepare an opening and closing statement. Each one will be 1 minute long.
And before we begin, though, a few ground rules. The debate is going to be divided into three sections: education, transportation and development, the opioid crisis. We'll spend about 15 minutes on each of those topics, and the candidates will have 1 minute to respond when we ask them a question directly. And the other candidate will have 30 seconds for a rebuttal. And we, the moderators, will be able to ask follow-up questions of both candidates' responses at our discretion. And we have a very dapper timekeeper there in the front who will be indicating to you about when you're running down on time for your responses or your rebuttals.
Between topics, we will ask a series of lightning round questions of each candidate. Listeners, there are several ways you can participate in today's debate. We're broadcasting a Facebook live feed of today's event. Go to bostonglobe.com, radioboston.org, or umb.edu, as well as on Facebook at WBUR to watch the feed and submit questions.
And we're also taking questions via Twitter. Use the hashtag MacGovDebate, MacGovDebate, MacGovDebate. So let's begin with our opening statements, and we will first hear from Jay Gonzalez. He is the former head of CeltiCare Health Plan and New Hampshire Healthy Families. He served as the Secretary of Administration and Finance under Governor Deval Patrick. Jay Gonzalez, welcome.
Thank you, and hello, everybody. With Trump taking us backwards every single day, it is more important than ever that we are leading right here in Massachusetts. But we're not leading under Charlie Baker. He's a status quo, wait-and-see governor, and it's not good enough. We need a governor who is going to see the way the world should be and take us to that place. Let's aim high. Let's aim high. As your governor, I will fight to ensure that every child and family in this state has access to high-quality, affordable childcare and preschool, a transportation system that people can actually depend on to get to work on time, a single-payer healthcare system that's simpler, cheaper, and does a better job keeping people healthy. I'll take on other big challenges like climate change and the opioid epidemic and our affordable housing crisis. And most important, I will stand up for every single person in this state. I'm offering an ambitious agenda to move us forward and the leadership experience to deliver on it, and I'm asking for your support.
Next up, I'd like to introduce Robert Bob Massey for his opening statement. Massey is a longtime environmentalist who ran unsuccessfully for lieutenant governor back in 1994 and briefly ran for U.S. Senate in 2011 until Senator Elizabeth Warren entered the race. He's also an ordained Episcopal minister, has a doctorate from Harvard Business School, and founded the Massachusetts Energy Efficiency Coalition. Bob Massey, welcome, and your opening statement.
Thank you very much. I am delighted to be back at UMass Boston. Go Beacons! That's my first set. I had the privilege of being here as the director of the Sustainable Solutions Lab, which was founded to tackle some of the interconnected problems we face. I am running for governor because I believe we have structural problems that cannot be answered by a single program or a single idea. We have an upside-down economy that is preventing people from moving forward. People cannot get into a good home or get a good education or get a good doctor or a good job. And when I look into the future, I see problems that we must tackle. Climate change, renewable energy, a comprehensive transportation system. I'm someone who has been a movement leader. I know how to bring people together. I know how to dream in the future to bring us so that we imagine what we really want. And I believe that we need to take on the problems today that are going to pay benefits tomorrow. We stand at a critical moment with a president who is getting ready to destroy our democracy and a governor who is not willing to object.
Thank you. We're going to start with opioids. Bob, before Charlie Baker took office, in an interview with The Globe just after his 2014 win, the governor vowed to make battling the opioid crisis a priority, saying it was, quote, going to be a big issue for his administration, and it starts with, quote, a prescription medication problem. The number of opioid-related overdose deaths ticked upward during his first couple years in office until 2017, when it dropped by 8.3%. What has Baker done right on the opioid epidemic? What has he done wrong? And what would you do differently?
Who's first?
You.
The governor, in general, talks about things and doesn't do them. So this is a great example of someone who came in and said this would be a priority, and he has not moved forward adequately on the critical distribution problems. He did not initially support going after the pharmaceutical companies, which we need to do to recoup those profits. He has not provided adequate beds. He even, serving on President Trump's commission headed by Kellyanne Conway, after they issued saying it was an emergency and that yet offered no new funding, he said it was a great report. So I've been with mothers who have lost their children. I have met with recovering addicts. I know what people need, and primarily that is treatment. Treatment, whether it's in prisons, whether it's before people offend, and this is something that I, as governor, intend to address systematically because it is an integrated and systematic problem.
So, Bob, just to be clear, what specifically would you do differently? Is the one specific thing you would focus on?
So, first of all, we need to increase funding. Secondly, we need to take people out of prison settings and increase the number of beds available. We have the problem that we just lost 700 beds out on Long Island. We need to build that bridge and bring people back. We need to also address the fundamental question of despair, which is driving people because they have no futures. So we need to put more money into local economies, more money into education, so people believe that they have a future rather than turning to addiction.
Thank you. And Jay, your turn. You get 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Yes.
Well, this is a crisis that is ruining people's lives and ravaging communities across our entire state. Governor Baker is not doing nearly enough to treat this and act aggressively to deal with this crisis. I was in a sober home in Gloucester with many people who would say that Charlie Baker's not doing nearly enough. I have a volunteer from my campaign who lost her son to an opioid overdose just a few weeks ago who would say that Charlie Baker is not doing enough. This is an issue that we need a governor that's going to provide leadership and take real action on, and we don't have that right now.
Thank you. Jay, the next question goes to you. You support establishing supervised injection sites in Massachusetts. Baker testified at a hearing before the Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Abuse, and Recovery in January that he is, quote, skeptical of the idea, saying, "The biggest problem I have with it is, as far as the data I see is concerned, it has not demonstrated any legitimate successes in creating a pathway to treatment." What have you seen that makes you believe supervised injection sites will help combat the addiction epidemic?
There is a lot of evidence from the places around the world that have done this that shows that it reduces addiction. It actually results in safer communities. And, you know, we're not going to be able to get people into treatment and recovery if they don't live. So we have to try some new things. We need to be aggressive in taking on this epidemic in our state. And I think safe injection sites is one of the innovative things we need to try that has been proven to work in other parts of the world. I've also proposed a number of other things that we need to do. Increasing treatment resources to meet the demand for treatment that is not currently sufficient. I think we should do things like make insurance companies provide coverage for medical marijuana as an alternative pain management strategy to opioid pills, which are getting people addicted and killing them. But we need to try new things in this area. This is an area that I actually have experience as CEO of a health insurance company that covered low-income people in the Medicaid program. The number one health issue of our membership was addiction. And we tried lots of things. We got good outcomes. The Boston Globe, Shira, named my company one of 46 game-changing companies in Massachusetts because of our innovative work in this area.
Thank you, Jay. And Bob, you get 30 seconds.
I went to visit a sample site, a safe injection site. When I walked in, it seemed very familiar to me because I was born with a serious illness, hemophilia, that could be treated with injections. So I recognized what you need if you're trying to get into your own veins. I had to do that for many, many years. And I can tell you that that's hard enough without trying to do it in a back alley with a shared needle, with getting HIV, with getting hepatitis C. This makes sense. The data proves it. I don't know what Charlie's reading, apparently not very much. And it just makes common sense. Because if you want to limit an epidemic, and you get people into a place get treatment. I'm sorry, very hard to see. I just wanted to tell you, very hard to see you, sir, with the backlight. So I completely support this, both to rescue people with addiction and to get them into treatment, which it has been shown
to
do.
Yeah.
So we'll have our timekeeper wave a little bit, so maybe the motion will
help.
You're
perfectly backlit.
There's some just so people. Yeah, there's some strong lights for the cameras here.
Yeah.
Bob, the next 1 minute question goes to you, and it's interesting to have heard Jay Gonzalez talk about we need aggressive solutions for the opioid crisis, because Governor Baker has an opioid bill currently working its way through the legislature that would, among other things, enable medical professionals to hold individuals involuntarily for 72 hours if their addiction could lead to serious harm. But the Mass Medical Society, representing some 25,000 medical professionals in the state, is against this provision. The society's president, Dr. Alan Chowie, is concerned that the state doesn't have the resources to enact the policy. Dr. Chowie says there continues to be uncertainty as to whether appropriate beds exist to care for these patients, and the ACLU has also argued against this proposal. I mean, if we are looking for bold, aggressive solutions to the opioid epidemic crisis, do you support involuntary treatment for those suffering from addiction?
No, and I don't, because this follows a pattern of trying to criminalize things that are the result of medical problems or other problems. This governor has also tended to favor the Republican approach to disobedience or problems in school, which is to criminalize, to arrest, to expel. This is a pattern, and it's a pattern that we have to use force if we can't prepare the adequate prior treatment to addiction and intervene effectively at that moment. I don't know where people would be put. I don't know how you make the judgment that people somehow are going to be harmed to themselves or others. To me, this is just fraught with civil liberties and other problems, and it goes down the wrong path of trying to use force to solve problems that ultimately need treatment.
Jay Gonzalez, I'll let you have a 30-second follow-up here, but just let me add something here. The legislature's Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Abuse, and Recovery approved the measure earlier this month. We have a state rep, Paul Tucker of Salem, saying what we're finding is that addicts are overdosing, leaving the emergency room, and ending up back there just a few hours later. We need to get more aggressive about treatment.
We need to get more aggressive about treatment, but this isn't the right way to do it. The senators on that committee did not vote for this. It'll be interesting to see what the Senate does. But their concerns are the same concerns as Mass Medical and many other practitioners in the field, that it's not going to do a lot of good to hold someone for 72 hours and force them to go into treatment if there isn't treatment there for them to receive. That is the fundamental problem, is we do not have the treatment resources in place, and we've got a governor that has not acted aggressively enough to put the resources into this that we need to meet the demand.
Hmm. Now, Jay, the next one-minute question goes to you, and this has to do with the law enforcement side of things, because a major focus of the really monumental criminal justice reform bill that passed through Beacon Hill last month was about mandatory minimum sentences and really rolling back many of them. The bill eliminated a number of previous mandatory minimums, but it also introduced new ones for trafficking of fentanyl and carfentanil. Now, as a result of that provision, the Seti Warren, who was once in this race, said that if he were governor, he would have vetoed the bill. Now, you're on record saying that's a mistake, but that you also favor eliminating all mandatory minimums except for first-degree murder. So why would you be willing to sign legislation that does introduce new mandatory minimums in Massachusetts?
Because while this legislation is not perfect from my perspective, it takes a huge step forward in addressing what I believe is the biggest civil rights issue of our time, and that is our broken criminal justice system, where we have been jailing way too many for way too long, and we need to be doing a much better job of addressing the underlying causes of crime instead. And this legislation, while it adds one or two new mandatory minimum sentences, it eliminates many others. It puts a focus on diversionary programs for people with mental illness and addiction instead of throwing them in jail. It provides resources for programming for people who are in jail so they're successful when they get out instead of ending up back in. Reforming our system of fees and fines so we aren't jailing people just because they're poor. It takes a lot of good steps in the right direction. And while I think we need to continue to work in this area to improve our criminal justice system, I would absolutely have signed this legislation. I think the legislature deserves a lot of credit, notwithstanding a total lack of leadership on Governor Baker's part for getting this done.
Bob Massey, I'll let you have your rebuttal here in just a second. I'll let you have your rebuttal in just a second, but Jay Gonzalez, I want to follow up with something. I mean, the ACLU says that Black and Latino residents of Massachusetts make up 75% of those serving mandatory minimums in this state right now. Wouldn't they be at greater risk for serving the new mandatory minimums around fentanyl and carfentanil? And wouldn't that be of harm to minority communities? Why is that okay?
If they are major traffickers of fentanyl and carfentanil, yes, they would be at risk of being subject to a mandatory minimum sentence. But if they were in possession of smaller levels of illegal drugs, where today they might end up with a mandatory minimum sentence, after this bill, they would not. And I would not want to look one of those young people of color in the eye who commits a first-time offense of an illegal drug possession that would have landed them with a mandatory minimum sentence in jail if this legislation were not passed. And that is why I would have signed it. There are many more people for whom this is going to do good and get us better outcomes for those individuals and for our communities than if we were to veto this legislation.
Bob Massey, your 30-second rebuttal.
The deeper problem here, as you started to ask, is a structural institutionalized racism, which is at the root of so many problems, not only criminal justice, but housing, jobs, healthcare, many other things. And we need a governor who understands that racism is a core problem, is willing to speak about it, is willing, in my case, as a white person, to invite other white people to reflect on their role in this. In terms of the criminal justice system, we do need to make progress. I've talked to many sheriffs about who say, why is it that people don't get services before we provide them with medical care, mental health care, and education in, and then we put them out where they don't have it again? This is part of a larger problem that needs to be addressed comprehensively.
Hmm. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your enthusiasm here. I very much do, but if I could just ask you to hold back on the applause, that'll give our candidates more time to speak in the aggregate. Now, for each one of these major topic areas, I also understand that, you know, they're very big and complex and mean a lot to people. We're not going to get to everything, but we want to push on ahead here, regardless. But before we move on to our next topic, we also want to give ourselves a chance to smile and have a little fun as well with some rapid-fire short answer questions. Emphasis on the short, some lightning round questions. Okay, so both of you, this is a quick lightning round, couple of quick lightning round questions. Jay Gonzalez, what's the last book you read?
The book, I'm forgetting the title, by Michelle Alexander on criminal justice reform.
Okay.
New Jim Crow, that's what it is. Yeah.
Bob Massey, the last book you read.
I just finished a book called The Sparrow, which is a science fiction book, and its follow-up book is called Children of God.
Jay, who is your favorite Massachusetts sports star?
Well, of course, Dustin Pedroia, another man of stature.
And Bob, same question for you.
Carl Yastrzemski, no question about it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
All right.
Okay. I'm gonna throw another sports question here. How many points are the Celtics gonna beat Cleveland by on Saturday?
What?
How many points are the Celtics gonna beat Cleveland by on Saturday?
I'm gonna say 12.
Ooh, tight.
756.
All right, shifting gears a little bit here. Jay, what is your favorite Dunkin' Donuts coffee flavor?
Black.
I like it regular, meaning with cream and sugar.
All right, and last thing that you binge-watched on Netflix, Jay Gonzalez?
I'm looking at my wife as I answer this question. The last thing we've started again is West Wing.
You need a break from politics, buddy. When I was 11, I was a huge fan of Lost in Space, and I was wildly in love with Angela Cartwright, it's true. So I have watched the first two episodes of the new Netflix Lost in Space.
Wow, great.
It's okay.
All right, so moving back to matters of policy here, let's talk about economic development, including the economy, housing, and transportation. Now, as you know, home prices, something that touches everybody, have risen faster than any in Massachusetts than virtually every other state in the country. Boston rent prices are the fifth highest in the nation, according to Zumper. Now, at the end of the year, Governor Baker announced his administration's plan to boost the housing stock. He wants to add at least 35,000 new homes in 8 years, proposed building more multifamily and affordable housing units, more money for cities and towns, $10 million in grant funding, and he wants to make it easier for towns and cities to change local zoning. So these are all proposals to make housing more affordable. So, Jay Gonzalez, starting with you, you get a minute here. What is your plan, you know, supplement to what the governor is doing or different from what the governor is doing to make housing more affordable in Massachusetts?
So first of all, it took 3 years for the governor to even focus on this issue, and when he did, he came up with something that, in my view, is not a plan. This is a crisis in this state. Affordable housing is one of two things, I think, this and transportation, that are starting to drag Massachusetts backwards. People aren't going to want to live here. They aren't going to be able to live here if they can't afford to. So I would do a number of things. First, exercise basic leadership skills. Identify the extent of the problem, set the goal we need for additional affordable housing, not just for very low income, but for all income classes through working and middle class, and develop a plan and execute against it. That plan needs to be different in different parts of the state where the affordable housing crisis looks different and has different elements and challenges to it. I think we need to better coordinate subsidies that state government provides for affordable housing. Right now, it's across a whole series of different agencies that don't speak to each other and work in isolation. We need regulatory reform, real regulatory reform, not what Charlie Baker did, reform that is actually going to result in the, while balancing local interests, with the production of additional affordable housing, not just in Boston and Cambridge and Somerville, but all across this state.
Thank you. Bob.
30 seconds?
We'll give you a minute to answer this. How would a Massey administration make all parts of the state more affordable and accessible, not just here in the Boston area?
Okay, I'm going to answer that and a piece of what Jay just talked about. First lesson is markets don't work by themselves. Markets, if left to themselves, build things like Dalton Place here in Boston, an enormous tower which is serving as a huge piggy bank for rich people who won't even live there. We need to improve transportation so that people can get around and connect the communities that have jobs with no houses with those who have houses and no jobs. We need new ownership models like land trusts and cooperatives and co-housing. I used to run something called the New Economy Coalition. There are hundreds of examples around the country that are being used. We need to stop redlining, which is still true. Lower-income people and communities of color do not have access to the kind of mortgages, and we need to increase wages and so that people have access to wealth, and we need to bring back equity-building models like the triple-decker in Somerville, where you could get in and buy a building, live on the first floor, put your mom and dad on the second, rent the third, and after 20 years, you own the whole building. By allowing that to go to condos, we cut off a way of building equity. Equity and ownership are the key to building wealth over time, and the central piece of that is housing.
Thank you. We're now going to move on to transportation. Jay, this first question is for you. You have expressed the need to substantially improve the MBTA's efficiency, but at an affordable cost, especially as it continues to carry a heavy debt burden. In the Patrick administration, you served as the Secretary of Administration and Finance, which is charged with managing the state's budget. As you know, the MBTA failed miserably short to the end of Patrick's tenure. Don't you and the previous administration bear some of the responsibility for the chronic underfunding of the MBTA? You have a minute.
No, Charlie Baker bears responsibility for the Big Dig finance plan that put billions of dollars of Big Dig costs on the MBTA decades ago and has resulted in its having insufficient resources to provide a system that people can actually depend on to get to work on time. In the Patrick administration, we actually increased funding for the MBTA, and under my watch overseeing the state budget, we invested in a number of projects that prior administrations had ignored, like the Fairmont commuter extension and others. So we took a step in the right direction for the first time. We have a long way to go. And this governor is taking the exact wrong approach, jacking up fares on riders, cutting service to cut costs, all of which drive more people to the roads. We need to be investing more in our system. We need to invest more money in it. It's one of the reasons I support the millionaires tax, which would generate meaningful new revenue we desperately need for transportation education. And I would fire Keolis. I'd be the first governor to stop this privatization, which is not working, and bring management of the commuter rail under direct control.
So let's just a quick follow-up. Let's say for argument purposes the millionaire's tax never makes it to the ballot. Are there any other funding streams for the MBTA that you would consider or advocate for?
Yes, and I've been clear about this. We need additional revenue for transportation education. It is the number one problem with our transportation system is we aren't investing enough in it. So I have said if the millionaire's tax is shot down by the Supreme Judicial Court or by the voters at the ballot, I would propose another progressive way to raise the income we need. We got to be honest about this. Charlie Baker is not being honest with people. To pretend that we don't need more money for transportation is going to result in this system that is not working for people, that affects people's quality of life in a very real way, and is going to continue to drag Massachusetts backwards.
Thank you. Bob, your response?
Probably the most important thing is we need a 10-year plan to solve this problem, not something here and something there. Everywhere I go in the state, 250 communities, this is what I hear about. But this is both a moral issue, a civil rights issue, which Dr. King said, because if you don't have transportation, it influences where you can get a job. It's also an economic issue for the state. We know that we are starting to fall behind. I'd like to buy Charlie a ticket to some part of the world which is competing with us, where they have built a modern high-speed rail system that we could have over the next 10 years if we committed to it, if we had the leadership.
Can I speak to this?
Actually, there is a specific question I want to ask Bob Massey, sure. And I'll give you a chance, Jay, to rebut to that. I mean, the governor has specified some very particular projects. I mean, he wants to make an investment in the South Station expansion, for example.
Bad idea.
And you've said it's a bad idea. You've actually even gone so far as to say you would cancel that project and divert the funds to a North-South rail link between North and South Stations. Now, the South Station expansion price tag is roughly $2 billion. A North-South rail link price tag, we're seeing somewhere $3 to $5 billion. My question for you is, I mean, if you were to even divert those funds, you'd still be $2 to $3 billion short for a North-South rail link. So where would that money come from?
Okay. Charlie says he thinks like a business person. He doesn't. Here's how business people or forward-thinking people. One, what is it we want? Number two, what would be the benefits? What would be the economic gains? Number three, what are other people doing? Number four, what does it cost us to do nothing? Number five, what would the price tag be? And number six, how do we pay for it? You don't start with number five. You start with the fact that our entire economy, through the state in Boston, is being held back. And if we don't do things like this, we are going to pay the price. Let me just give you an example. The Chinese have 12,000 miles of high-speed rail. We have zero. They made that investment. Who do you think's ahead? 12,000 to zero. We have to make commitments to spend so that we reap the benefits in the future. That's called investment, and that's what I would do as governor.
Jay, I'll give you 30 seconds here.
I mean, Charlie Baker's approach to everything is where are we, what do we have, and what's the best we can do, instead of where do we need to be and how do we get there. His plan for fixing the MBTA is that it will be fixed in 15 years. That's his plan, and he's not even on track. So, you know, we do need a long-term plan, but we need to give people relief now. We need a sense of urgency around this. And if I'm governor, we will fix the T a lot faster than Charlie Baker.
Okay, I have one more follow-up for the both of you. And I'm going to, at moderator's discretion, I'm just going to give you both 30 seconds for this. Because hovering around at the edges here is a massive revolution in transportation, which we are beginning to see with ride hailing, for example. We've already had a couple of handful of reports that say ride hailing is siphoning off what would be ridership on the MBTA, and it's causing greater congestions on the streets of eastern Massachusetts at the very least. I mean, how would you lead Massachusetts through that transportation revolution, and would you actively advocate and seek greater funds in the form of taxes and surcharges from companies like Lyft and Uber? Jay, you can go
well,
first.
Look, we have to deal with reality and the way the world is moving and anticipate the way the world is moving. And ride hailing is here and growing. Driverless cars are here and growing. And we need to account for all of this in our long-term transportation planning. Our ultimate goals need to be mobility for people, affordable, accessible, convenient, safe mobility for people. And right now, we are one of the least mobile places in the country. 47th in commute times, 45th in the condition of our infrastructure. We have to do better.
Bob, 30 seconds.
I'm the only person who's been talking about the long-term impact of artificial intelligence and other technologies that will change our economy. And most particularly, driverless cars don't have drivers, meaning that we lose taxi drivers, we lose those who are trying to supplement their income, Uber and Lyft. Ultimately, we lose truck drivers. We, as governor, I would appoint a commission on the future of work that would establish the implications. And by the way, we don't have to accept every technology that comes along. We could license, restrict, or slow down the implementation of these technologies until we have adequate processes to protect people. That's, I think, what governors do.
All right, let's talk about Amazon. As you both know, unless something has changed in the last 20 minutes, the Boston area is still in the running for Amazon's HQ2, which promises to bring 50,000 jobs and possibly some $5 billion investments to the area. According to a poll of Boston residents from Elon University and the Business Journals, Boston has emerged as one of the least supportive of the 20 remaining in the race. 34% of those polled strongly support Amazon HQ2 coming here. Jay, does Massachusetts need Amazon, and should the state be making great efforts to try and bring it here?
Massachusetts doesn't need it. It'd be great, of course, to have Amazon come here and 50,000 new jobs, but the last thing we should be doing is spending taxpayer money to get Amazon, one of the wealthiest corporations in the world, to come to Massachusetts. We need to be investing instead in workforce training, in this transportation crisis we have, in affordable housing. The best thing government can do for economic development is to do the stuff it's supposed to do well, not be giving lots of money to Amazon. The other thing I think we need to be clear-eyed about is our infrastructure. A lot of the challenges we've been talking about is not sufficient to support the economy we have here today and the jobs we have here today. I'd be very surprised, honestly, if Amazon decides to come to Massachusetts in light of those huge challenges. And if they do decide to come here, we better get ready, because we have a lot of work to do without them coming here. We're going to have much more to do to support this economy and people and businesses in Massachusetts if they do.
Thank you. Bob.
When we were first asked about this question about 6 months ago, my opponents were very much in favor. I said I do not favor Amazon except under very strict conditions. Number one, I don't believe we should be giving money to big corporations. We should be taking that same money and putting it into small business. I believe in local economies. I want to put money into the next Amazon, the future Amazon that's being built right here in Massachusetts. I don't know where we get the 50,000 housing units to put the 50,000 people. And I don't believe that our whole economic strategy should be to kowtowing to big corporations, which don't need it, which do not create the benefit, and which hold it over our head when at the very moment we need to be focusing on other things.
All right, so let's take a quick moment here for another little lightning round. So let me just ask you quickly, Bob, I'll just start with you. Where do you think the best place for dinner is in Massachusetts?
Oh, I don't want to tell you. Little Vinny's in East Somerville, but don't go there, please. It's a wonderful Italian restaurant at the back of a super rat in Somerville.
Jay?
At home with my family.
Jay.
My wife's sitting in the front row.
No choice there. Jay, what is your favorite place to get away for a weekend in Massachusetts?
I have many. One is the Vineyard. I love Martha's Vineyard. Portland, Maine, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, a number of different places.
Bob?
Well, you said in Massachusetts that would have to be the Pioneer Valley. I love Pioneer Valley. The place that I go for the deepest rest is a place that my grandparents got in Maine many, many years ago.
And Bob, one more lightning round question for you. Who do you think the 2020 Democratic nominee for president should be?
I hope Bernie Sanders runs.
Jay, same question for you.
I look forward to seeing who ends up running for the Democratic nomination for president, and I hope as governor to help that person get elected.
Can I add a quick question? I think we should all ask, who is Charlie Baker going to vote for in 2020? Head of his own party?
Well, remarkably, he's not here, so we'll ask him that when we talk to him on the Republican side
Please
of things. But we have one more major area of issues and questions to talk about with both of you, and that has to do with education. And because we are here at UMass Boston, let's start with a question from a UMass professor. Erin O'Brien, actually. Thank you so much.
Hello. My name is Erin O'Brien, and I'm an associate professor here at UMass Boston of political science, the only UMass Boston needs. But that is not my question. My question is, U.S. News and World Report, amongst others, consistently places K-12 education in the Commonwealth as first in the country. Yet, when it comes to public higher education, Massachusetts has cut funding and cut scholarships every year since 2001, even as tuition goes way up. The research also shows that students that are educated at our public institutions here stay here and contribute here. My question then becomes, Democrats are known for valuing higher education, yet this deep blue state is in the back of the pack. What, if anything, would your administration do to reverse these trends? And as a political scientist, I would love some specificity.
And the first, and Jay Gonzalez, you'll answer first here.
So thank you for the question, and I couldn't agree more. This is a huge priority of mine, and one of the reasons I'm running is we've got too many people in this state who can't afford to go to public higher education, our community colleges, our public universities, like this great institution, UMass Boston, and they either aren't going or they're going and they have huge debt at the end of the day, and we are not supporting the institutions at the level we need to provide the great quality education to those people, as you pointed out, are going to end up staying in Massachusetts and driving our economy forward. So I want to invest more in it. It's one of the reasons I support the so-called millionaire's tax, which would generate new revenue we need for this and other reasons. And I want to say, UMass Boston, in particular, has been treated like a second-class citizen. When I worked in the Patrick administration, even during the Great Recession, when we didn't have the resources to start really investing more in public higher education, we did figure out ways to build a lot of these new buildings that are around here that I had something to do with. And I would be an advocate for UMass Boston.
Okay. Bob Massey, you get 30 seconds to respond.
Here in Massachusetts, we established the principle that a democracy needs a well-informed citizenry as part of democracy and for the economy. And our legislature has backed away from that. Going back to the tax cut we gave ourselves in 2008, we have seen funding drop by 23% for education and for higher education. In the years I spent here at UMass Boston, I saw just how much of a penalty that is. Very hard to be specific in 30 seconds. I would be the strongest governor for UMass Boston in the history of the state, and that means that I would make sure you get your funding and that we put this university back on track to providing the education for the wonderful people here. If you want to see the future, you come to UMass Boston, and that's a future I want to invest in.
All right. Bob, this next question is for you, and it's along those lines. U.S. Representative Stephen Lynch suggested this week that UMass Boston might be better off as an independent college separate from the larger UMass system. Do you think that is a solution or a good solution for some of the problems confronting this campus?
I haven't looked at his proposal. It's hard for me to imagine that when we have a unified system which can share resources and share investments, that a good idea for this underserved, undersupported community be cut it off. So in my first reaction, no, I think it's a bad idea.
I don't think it's a good idea. I think the problem we have is we have a university system that isn't acting like a system. Mm. I mean, the fact that UMass Amherst has the resources to buy Mount Ida, a campus in the Boston area, 10 miles from where we're standing, yet there are cuts to programs and professors and resources here at UMass Boston. It is insulting. It's insulting. I think what we need is a system that acts more like a system. And to hear our system's president and our governor talk about their number one priority being worried about the students at Mount Ida, yeah, we should be worried about the students at Mount Ida. But the students here at UMass Boston, who I came and met with right after that proposal was announced, deserve attention and support. And as their governor, I would support them.
So we're gonna get to another Mount Ida question here in just a second, but I want to ask you both specifically, and I'll give you both 30 seconds for this because it's a very simple question. I mean, last year, state universities approved a 3% tuition increase. Many schools also increased fees to offset stagnant funding from the state. This is something we've seen year after year. I mean, we can talk about the state funding higher ed more, but what would you do to make sure colleges and universities are running efficiently and controlling their costs on the other side of the ledger? And Jay, I'll start with you.
Well, right now, they're overseen by independent boards that the governor has a lot of authority over appointing. His own Secretary of Education voted for this acquisition by UMass Amherst of the Mount Ida campus and is voting to force UMass Boston to make all these cuts that are harming people here. I would put people in place who are providing the governance oversight that are consistent with my values and what I believe to be the values of the people of this state to make sure we are supporting our public university system.
And Bob Massey, I'll give you 30 seconds for this also.
So we have a state GDP that's almost $500 billion, and yet we see everything that is part of our infrastructure starting to crumble. What you need is a governor who goes out and who says, here is what we could be doing, here is how much it would cost. Do you want to coast on the experiences and the success of the past, or do you want to seize the opportunity and compete globally and support the people at the bottom? I have always fought. I am a lifelong economic justice, racial justice, gender justice activist who has been a teacher, and I would bring that debate and urge the higher funding relentlessly across the state, not sit in my office staring at the kind of screens that Charlie Baker spends most of his time doing.
Snow, now back to Mount Ida. The closure of Mount Ida has left students and parents fuming. UMass President Marty Meehan told state senators yesterday that Mount Ida's situation was not unique. Quote, there are going to be other closures. This is going to happen over and over and over again. It's around the corner. When asked by senators if the school was honest about its financial situation with prospective students, Carmen Reese, the chair of Mount Ida's Board of Trustees, said, did we go out and announce, hello, interested students, we're teetering on the brink of insolvency, but come on in? No, we didn't do that. Should colleges, and a question for you, and Bob, you first, should colleges and universities be forced to be more open about their financial situation, and how will you deal with small colleges or universities that find themselves in a similar situation to Mount Ida? Bob.
So we have 29 institutions of higher education, if you include our community colleges and our what used to be called state colleges in the UMass system. Each one of those is an anchor institution in the local community. And rather than talking about cutting them, I want to expand their role in the local community so that they're open for more hours, so that they offer lifelong learning, so that they offer additional training, so they become centers of public development and public wealth. And that's something that has not been proposed. And so if you're talking about private colleges do face relentless upward pressure, and I do favor more transparency about the situation that they're in. I also think with the major private colleges here that have immense, immense endowments have a role to play in supporting some of the others in the state.
Thank you. Jay.
Yes, there should be transparency, and the state should be overseeing what's happening to ensure that when private colleges get in trouble, there are plans in place to make sure we're protecting students and mitigating the impacts on students. And so the real question, why wasn't there under this current situation? You know, this is another example of a situation where Charlie Baker says, I don't know what happened there, and I'm disappointed about it. Or I'm disappointed about what's happening at the Registry of Motor Vehicles or at the Department of Revenue with data breaches or with Keolis. He's the governor. He is the governor. And he needs to be held accountable for making sure that the job of state government to protect people like these students is being done.
Thank you.
Okay. We're getting near the time where we're going to move to closing statements. But before that, I do want to give you both 1 minute to answer the following question. And that is, before one of you runs against Governor Baker in November, you are running against each other. It's the Democratic primary in September. So again, 1 minute for both of you. Can you please tell us exactly how you differ from your Democratic primary opponent? And Bob Massey, I'll let you go first.
I am a movement leader. I look into the future. I am informed by the people around me, the community and grassroots. I help, and we work together to imagine where we should go. And then I am good at inspiring or pushing or requiring change to take place. I have done this all over the country, all over the world. I've invented some of the most effective global institutions that created substantive change. It's true that I haven't spent time in the state government. I've been busy making change on the environment, on our economics, on fighting corporate power, on fighting for economic justice, and fighting for racial justice. That's my entire life, and I am proud of the work that I've done. I believe that as governor, I would bring that passion, that focus, that skill, that backbone, that determination, and a much bigger toolkit than anybody who is normally running for governor, because I have worked across the board with all the different mechanisms of social change. This is a moment of crisis, it's a moment of opportunity, and I believe I have the exact set of skills and the character to make it happen.
So, Jay, thank you. Jay, you know, I don't want these to sound like closing statements, because there's a specific question. I mean, Jay Gonzalez, how do you differ from Bob Massey?
Two things. One, I think based on my experience, I'm best positioned to deliver on the type of ambitious, progressive agenda this state needs. And two, I think based on my experience, I'm best positioned to beat Charlie Baker in the general election. In terms of my leadership experience, I'm the only one of the two of us that has leadership experience in state government getting big things done. I was Governor Patrick's Secretary of Administration and Finance, not only oversaw the state budget, but was often his point person for negotiating a lot of the big things we got through the legislature during that time. I've been there, I've done it, I know how the process works, and it is unlike any other place. And I think that should matter, because I think I'm best positioned to deliver on that type of agenda we need. The second thing is beating Charlie Baker. His whole case for being governor is he's a great manager. He's failed at it. We need to expose his failings as a manager. Every single thing he said he's going to fix is worse. I'm going to be able to go toe-to-toe with him on this and credibly expose his failings. When I was there managing the state budget, we did so successfully, got the highest bond ratings in state history. He screwed it up. And I'm going to hold him accountable for his management failures.
Can I?
Oh, no, actually, because we've just got 3 minutes to go before all these mics get turned off here. So it is time for closing statements, actually. Again, Bob, we're going to give you each 1 minute, and I'm going to really hold it to a minute. Bob Massey, you get to begin with your closing statement.
Well, I'm going to pick up right where Jay left off. I do not think that someone who says, hey, Charlie, you were ANF director, I was ANF director. You were head of a healthcare company, I was head of a for-profit healthcare company. I don't think that's going to move anybody. I think what people want is a fresh start, a fresh voice, someone who has a deep understanding of what people at the grassroots in places like Somerville are feeling and in the communities and across the country and the world. We need to compete in the world. We need to be ready to take on the challenges of sustainability. We need to fight climate change. We need to move to renewable energy. We do not need more of the tinkering around the edges on the budget or the funding of this or that program. I have the experience that has caused dramatic, deep and permanent change, and I believe that I can do that. I want to do that. I want us to come together to do that, because this is the moment that I think we need to be worthy of the history of Massachusetts, and I invite you to support me as we move forward in this race. Thank you.
Jay Gonzalez, you get the last word today. You have 1 minute.
Elections are about choices, and in this case, the voters of Massachusetts are going to have a choice between a governor who is dragging Massachusetts backwards, has made no difference in people's lives, and has failed when it comes to standing up for people, versus someone who wants to make Massachusetts a leader again, will take on the big challenges we face, and will stand up for every single person in this state. That is the leadership I'm offering, and I think people are going to choose that. But we need your help. Our campaign has a lot of momentum. We have the support of both of the biggest progressive organizations in Massachusetts, from lots of progressive Democratic legislators, from one of the MBTA unions, the largest state employee union, from thousands of Democratic activists and supporters all across this state. I'm hoping you will join our team, too, because with your help, I am 100% confident we will win this election. We will win back the governor's office, we'll make Massachusetts a leader again, and we will make a meaningful difference in people's lives. Thank you very much.
Well, I would like to thank both Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey for this wonderful debate today. That is all the time that we have. Thank you to our partners as well at the Boston Globe, to Shira Center specifically, Boston Globe politics editor, for co-hosting with me today.
Thank you. We also want to thank our other co-sponsors, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. And thanks to our audience on air, online, and here at UMass Boston.
That's right. And you can listen back to the full debate on our websites, radioboston.org or bostonglobe.com. And no matter what party you belong to, the primaries are in September. Exercise your right to vote, please. And with that, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thank you again. This is Radio Boston.